2023.
Happy New Year.
Is it 23 or is it 22?
It's 23. Welcome. I've been here for a minute and I just want to welcome you guys. I was waiting for you guys to get here. Okay. Cool, right?
It's pretty cool. It seems, feels a little bit like last year, but...
No, it's way different. Also, the episodes are way different too. This is so insane. Come on, join me. Welcome to Smart Less.
Smart.
Yeah, hi guys.
Hey,
Sean and I were just I'm getting down a late breakfast here with the oatmeal. He doesn't.
So disgusting.
He says he doesn't. Listen, I Sloppy try, when Joe. I, when I, with you,
when I was really
you eat
little,
the worst crap no, on the world in the
no,
world,
no.
and you won't eat oatmeal.
No, when I was really young, I had issues about being so thin, and like you know, I think we mentioned this
Me
before.
Too, I was too thin.
I used to get made fun of for being super skinny.
Right.
And so I would eat tons of oatmeal and milkshakes and ice cream and burgers, and I couldn't gain...
Oatmeal doesn't make you fat.
No, but oatmeal had a lot of protein in it, so I was trying to, like, gain weight and muscle weight and all that, but I just couldn't handle
it. But it's so good.
Let's take a look in that bowl again. Let's just look at
it. It would help clean out all of the garbage you put in your system, Sean.
I know, that's true.
You know,
that
get,
is
like,
true.
That little bike license plate out of you. you know?
That says 8-wheeler on it.
What do you usually have for breakfast? Are you a breakfast guy?
Well, remember last time I said I had chili and cornbread.
Oh, right.
But usually, because I never really eat breakfast. I usually wait till like lunch to eat something, and then I'll eat like, you know, like tuna fish sandwich or whatever.
Right,
so that's kind of
like
my breakfast.
Willie, you're not a breakfast guy, are you?
No, it depends. Sometimes on the weekend I am. I'm a late morning. Little snack.
And will you cook up a breakfast for the kids? Are you one of those guys?
I don't usually cook up like school day. They don't want breakfast now because they're older in the morning before school. So like they'll have like toast.
But we FaceTimed last week like at 10 o'clock at night and Abel was in the background.
Eating cereal.
And I'm like, Abel, what are you eating? He's like, cereal.
Yeah.
At 10 o'clock at night.
I love cereal.
I love cereal. They both do. Both the kids, we eat dinner so early, so both of the older kids generally hit that thing where at about 8, 9 o'clock, they get real snacky.
But will you worry about them going to school without food? Like, I've always got like a power bar for the girls in the car going to school, making sure they got something.
Oh, I always make sure that they eat something at home. They sit at the counter and eat something at home before they go. Usually like cereal, yogurt with granola or some kind of a cereal
or toast. Sugary cereal. I've seen your pantry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know you've seen I think you got the wrong impression.
It's envy. Wrong impression? So when I'm looking at Frosted Flakes, it's not really Frosted Flakes?
No, because, like, for instance, the Frosted Flakes that you're referring to have been
three
in
boxes.
That container. No, not three boxes at all. And have been there for so long.
Yeah. This is just so above the Oreos, right? It's just above the three different kinds of Oreos?
By the way, the Oreos are in those little packages. And they were, again, were for the kids for school. They were snacks. I can't remember the last time I saw somebody in this house eating Oreos. I think it was you when you came in and grabbed them.
Yeah, well, I've run into your pantry. It's my first stop because we have, you know, oats and barley and quinoa at this house.
It's disgusting.
Which I love, but I do like to shake it up every once in a while.
You don't love it.
Remember when we had dinner a while ago, Jay, and I said, before I come over, can Amanda please get me a Coca-Cola?
Yeah, I think she did. She bought a few of them.
Yeah.
All right, listen.
Yeah,
I'm pulling up my, I spent some time on this intro here.
Because this is your guest.
Yeah, this is not some silly guest. Tighten up. Today we've got a guest that is the closest thing to a magician that we've ever had. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, he doesn't pull bunnies out of hats or miraculously saw women in half. He is able to magically take us into environments and experiences that not only feel and look real, but they manage to access our most protected and personal places of thought and emotion. He does this with incredible writing, extraordinary images, and raw performances. He has received 5 Academy Awards, including Best Director in back-to-back years. Only the third person ever do that.
Really?
He's the youngest of 7 kids. He was kicked out of high school. He became a radio DJ. He became a cargo boat sailor. He eventually found a camera to play with. And thank God, because this man has brought us some of the best films ever made. Films like
this guy?
Babel, Birdman, The Revenant, and his latest and perhaps greatest, Bardo. Please welcome one of my heroes, Alejandro Iñárritu.
No way.
Alejandro?
Hey, how are you guys?
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning, guys.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
We're classing it up today.
Well, you Jason. Really classed it up.
Right?
This is incredible.
Yeah, see, these guys, they can't. I've never heard them so quiet. They're stunned.
I know. I was like,
we are stunned.
Second you started naming the films, I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, you thought it was a joke. So I saw Bardo last night. And it truly is, I think, given even with all the films that you've done, it could be your best. Do you feel like, I think I've read something where you said that you think it might be your best, and that's saying something.
Well, first of all, thank you for that incredible, generous introduction that you gave.
I can't wait.
So this is our strategy, though. We build you up, and then we're going to hit you with some really embarrassing questions.
And I was just like having a hungry, just listening to you about the breakfast. I have some chilaquiles, guys.
Uh-huh.
That's the Mexican way to go in the morning.
Chilaquiles, they're in your movie. Yeah.
Exactly. Chilaquiles and frijoles.
So what do you think? Do you think Bardo's your best? It's a big statement.
What I felt about Bardo and I feel about Bardo is that I think it's the film that I have spent much more time with, mm-hmm. cooking it, you know, preparing it and conceiving it, and then all the things that I have learned, I think, that technically and how to say things, the material or the fabric of this film was very complex, so I was very happy just to have made it, you know, that I could turn that thing into something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I consider that I think it's my, the film that I felt that I have accomplished in a better way or in a much more honest way, close to my heart, you know, that's why I consider it that.
You felt that maybe you asked yourself to bring everything that you have learned thus far technically and also, I mean, emotionally and spiritually. I mean, it is. So just for you, Sean and Will, and also the listeners, Bardo is, and I had to look this up, it is a, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alejandra, it is a Tibetan phrase that means, or describes the place post-death and pre-rebirth or reincarnation. So it's sort of that, some people call it,
purgatory?
Purgatory purgatory is a place between heaven and hell, I think. But so the film spends a lot of time or toggles back and forth between what could be real or could be this nether place or I don't think that's spoiling anything, Alejandro. I hope it's not. But it obviously lends itself to a lot of filmmaking techniques. Both visually and
I can't wait to see this.
So in just sort of the storylines of things, it's very, very beautifully complex. Not complicated, not difficult, but just so rewarding. It does ask of you everything that you've learned, certainly it seems.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that, Jason. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, basically in the Catholic tradition is kind of what we know as limbo, which is that kind of purgatory where little kids that are not baptized, they go after if they die. But it's a very narrow kind of conception. And Bardo in the Buddhist tradition is exactly that. When something dies, you know, something is transforming to another place, but it's in the between, you know, it's exactly in the middle point before to becoming something. And and that's kind of the concept of that word, the way I wanted to use it, you know.
Yeah, it's so exciting as a viewer. You never know whether it is current time or a flashback or real or imagined or dreamscape or not. Do you remember the Adrian Lyne film, guys, Jacob's Ladder?
Sure, yeah.
Where it's basically about, you don't know until the end that where we have been is on this guy's, you know, deathbed, and he's sort of purgatory, but it allows the film to travel in so many crazy spaces, and it's talk to me a little bit about the writing process of that. The not only putting in all of your, clearly deeply felt emotional places, but also playing with time and the complexity of the nonlinear aspect, you're constantly flashing forwards or back or real or unreal. Was that difficult or was it simple for you?
No, actually, I think was one of the most challenging things, I will say, and scary because there was no recipe, you know, because structurally, you know, in the film, you can play very well with flashbacks or flash aheads, and they are very, I will say, constructed in a way that they are very, in a way, immediately you recognize that the film has shifted or traveled to another thing. You can use different photography or different things to point out that kind of thing. So these are more conventional narratives or grammatical ways that you can use in filmmaking. And I think I love that film, by the way. I haven't seen it in a long time. Now you're going to see it again. I remember Jacob's Ladder was amazing with Tim Robbins, right?
Tim Robbins.
Yeah, but in this case, the challenge was that this film, Bardo, is a walk in the consciousness of somebody, right? Which is all memories and images and reflections and thoughts and emotions are basically interacting simultaneously and coexisting in the way when we dream, you know, and we are, and you know, when you have a lucid dream, that you are aware that you are dreaming, you know that things are off or some person is in a place that should not be there. Or maybe you are in your uncle's house, but the one guy is there and then the house becomes something else in your garden. And
you have a little bit of control over it too sometimes in a dream, right? Like you do in this film. You know,
well, you know, really quick, a super quick story about Jimmy Burrows. You know James Burrows, Alejandro? He's a TV director, friend of ours. I was in New York, and I'd just flown there. I was super, super, super tired from working all week and then the flight and everything. I laid down for a nap in the hotel. And in my dream, our sweet friend Jimmy Burrows, something, he was like having a heart attack or something in my dream. I was like, oh no, I gotta help him, I gotta help him. So I pick up the, you know, in the dream, I'm like, I'm dialing 911. I call the ambulance, everybody comes, it's so freaky. And then the hotel phone rings and it wakes me up from my nap. And I go, hello? And they say, yeah, 911, what's your emergency? So I called.
While you were sleeping.
While I was sleeping, but it seems so
like
real.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? That's never happened to me before.
Yeah, it's dreams are an incredible place. I think we had James Cameron on the podcast the other day, Alejandro, and I think we said to him he would be an incredible filmmaker, as would you, to tackle dreams, to do a film about dreams. It would take somebody of your skill or his to tackle all that. It's a rich place for a film. All right, so your films benefit so much from your visual strategy. Where can you trace that back to? You certainly didn't learn that in your brief radio career, did you? Where did you get that that taste for visuals and the technical know-how of it?
So I will say that I'm still trying to learn a lot. I think my guide always has been music. You know, I think I have a better ear. And I try to first kind of listen to the film and kind of determine what kind of genre it is and what is the rhythm and the sound and the beat. And then the question that I have been much more always is challenging for me is the point of view. You know, which point of view I would like to be putting the audience. Mm-hmm. And that is what really makes me decide how I'm going to shoot. So those two things really help me to understand how I want the audience to leave the experience, because I would like them to leave depending in the point of view, which sometimes get complicated when you have 2-3 characters or 4 characters in a scene. So you want to have the, you know, to receive or to land the emotional kind of challenge of a scene in somebody's. And that is always a tough question for me that I have to answer. And then I decide where I put the camera and how open. And then about the context, no? Because in the first films I did, I normally tend to isolate the characters. And I was very keen into the close-ups, which I think is an incredible landscape to show everything and emotional and everything was going on. But then little by little, in the last three films, I have been very obsessed about the context of the character, you know, what really make that character a character. And so then I have been trying to involve more and more the context of the situation. And I have been now rejecting every lens that is more than 21. I felt that is like a long lens. You know what I mean? I feel like.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be right back.
We get support from Canva. When your work, presentations, and docs look good, you look good. And you can design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform. It helps people design compelling visual content and is great for designing any type of presentation and great for any teammate. So our team at Smartless is using Canva when they're coming up with different design concepts for various things with related to Smartless and Smartless Media, because we have a lot of stuff going on. It's a busy crew, okay? And if it wasn't for Canva, they'd all be fired. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Canva presentations, docs, videos, and more. In just a few seconds, you can generate slides and text from a prompt. AI is built into Canva right where you work, so you can stay on task without any app switching. It's AI that's easy to learn and even easier to use. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva is perfect for any work task. Sales decks, hiring docs, marketing brainstorms, employee videos, you name it. Anyone at work can design with Canva. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work. Thank you to one of our new sponsors, My Mochi Ice Cream, for supporting the show. I just discovered cookies and cream, My Mochi Ice Cream, and I'm a little obsessed, but I'm a lot obsessed. Do you not know what My Mochi Ice Cream is? Picture this. It's a perfect little scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream wrapped in the softest, sweetest dough known to mankind. My Mochi Ice Cream is sweet, it's chewy, it's cool, it's creamy, all at the same time. It comes in tons of fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. That cookies and cream, I've always been a cookies and cream fan, but then when I had the My Mochi, oh my gosh, I mean, I was like, my mouthy loved it. First of all, an absolute knockout. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are gluten-free and about 90 calories each. You can find My Mochi at Target or go to mymochi.com to find your nearest grocery store. Discover the cool, creamy, joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today. We get support from Happy Egg. I love starting my morning off with farm fresh eggs full of flavor. At Happy Egg, all of their hens roam on 8 or more acres of land, leaving no mystery to why their eggs are the best. These hens are raised on 8-plus acres. I got to keep it down, because if my hens find out, they don't have 8-plus acres. My hens only have like 3/4 of an acre. And they're going to go on strike. Anyway, all of their hens are cared for by small family farmers and live their best hen lives day in and day out. All of this results in eggs with plump orange yolks that are full of flavor. I just, as I mentioned, I like to kick off my morning with farm fresh eggs. The difference is so glaring between an egg from Happy Egg and an egg that just came from clearly some kind of like sad factory. And you just have to taste it for yourself. If you're a fan of eggs, which I am, do yourself this favor and try Happy Egg eggs. You will not be disappointed. You will notice the difference immediately. Get with the Happy Eggs. They're so good. Next time you're at the store, look for the yellow carton. Choose Happy
with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com/smartless to find a store near you. And if you come by the house, don't mention it to my aunts.
And now back to the show.
Can I talk to you a little bit about, because it's funny you say that, because I forget, we were talking to somebody, but I think we were talking to a director about it, about this idea of, if you look at a lot of those films from the 70s, like even Spielberg in the 70s, one thing that comes to mind is like Close Encounters. So many of those scenes played with virtually no coverage at all.
Right. And everybody's and talking over each other.
Everybody's talking over each other, and you had these scenes that played out in these big sort of, almost masters, and sometimes, characters would come in and out of the scene. And
yeah, Robert Altman did a lot of that, and Woody Allen.
Robert Altman did that as well, and so that you got to talk about context. I mean, you got to kind of see so much of the world, and we've become, and not to get too deep in the weeds on this, but do you feel like we've become too dependent on close-ups, especially when you come to things like comedy, because it ends up, I love seeing at least two characters in the same frame together reacting off each other in a way that doesn't feel like you're telling me how I should be reacting to this. You allow the scene to play out and I can decide for myself what I feel about the story and their relationship.
Yes, I think you're right. I think, like, if you see Billy Wilder, for example, comedies, he always was, like, really much more relaxed, and the things were happening in front of you. And as you said, the characters come close to the camera or further, and that is kind of the blocking of that. And Spielberg is the master of blocking actors, I think, every film.
Staging is so
incredible. I think he's the best in the world doing
that. Yeah, Will, I feel the same way, like, whenever there's, like, a film about, like, dance, or, like, I'm watching, like, a cheerleading thing on ESPN or whatever, where, like, the camera, like, if you go in close to watch a whole dance number, it's like... No, yeah, I can't see it. the whole point of a dance number.
No, you want
to see everybody doing it at the same time,
so that it's 5, 6, 7, 8, and not cut to 7, 8. You want to see 5, 6, 7, 8 in the same frame.
That's
no, but I do. I think that that's true, and I think that we have been. You know, it's so funny when you go and you work, Alejandro. As my experience as an actor, certainly. Is when you go and you work on stuff, people are so scared and everybody's so nervous now of protect. So it's always like for protection. Well, we're just going to do so that when I go and do stuff on my own and I go where I'm kind of the boss or I'm running the show or whatever, and I'll go, they'll go like, well, we should get the other thing. I go, no, I'm never going to use it. Well, shouldn't we get just to have it? I go, no, I don't give a shit. I'm never going to use it.
Yeah.
Fucking, I know how I'm going to cut it, and I don't give a shit. And well, I think it would be really important. And you want to be like, to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the one shot, the oneer, is super good for that, right?
For a oneer,
Alejandro,
for sure.
You use that a lot, right? With you don't even give yourself an option in the editing room. You're going to stay there till you get it, and you're going to dictate to the audience where you're looking, when you're looking, and you never tap them out of it by making a cut. You keep it all smooth in one thing so that it stays sort of meditative and you're in it. Yes?
Exactly. And I think every film demands different things, so not all the films needs to be that way. I think, again, I think I learned it to do that by necessity in Birdman, that was the one that radically I knew that I wanted to make this as an spaghetti experience, right? That it was all tied together, and I wanted that the people feel in the head of Michael Keaton, and it was a radical point of view of one single moment that was, again, shifting in time, but I want the people to be in his head. So I designed the whole shooting based on one single shot, obviously with stitches.
So
but
fun.
That was a radical thing.
Yeah, it was mind-blowing.
Did Sam Mendes or Roger Dinkins come to you and talk to you about some of the tricks before they did 1917?
Yeah.
No, I think Sam and Royer, they are masters. Yeah. You know, they know exactly what they did in 1917. Yeah. I think it's something that... Again, I think it's the demand of the film, but it's very fun. I just find too that I agree with you when you were saying about coverage, right? To be cover yourself all the time is not healthy, because then there is no. I like when there is limits, no, like principle, not rules, because I don't like to use rules, but principle. And if the principle of the film has as limit or a frame or borders, I think it's much more fun work that way. And you say, okay, this is going to be the principle and the design of this film, and then you stick with that. It forces you to explore whatever rules or principles you set up. I think everybody go into that, and it's much more exciting, I think, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine after receiving the Academy Award back-to-back, I would imagine the pressure on you going forward or just sort of the expectations, like, you know, eyes are going to be on you. Does it limit the kind of swing you want to take going forward? You know, it must be tough.
Yeah, I think yes, it's true. It's true that the expectations always, you know, play against you in some way. But at the same time, it's challenging. After The Revenant, something that I really appreciate was that I took a time to do a virtual reality installation that I have never done, that was called Carne y Arena.
Yeah.
And it was a very radical point of view, because I put you a headset and then I put you in a space, a big space with sand, and you were bare feet. So you were, and it was about immigrants crossing the border in the desert at dawn. And you were sensorially feeling the air of the helicopter coming. So you were walking, and basically you become the camera. So you were a ghost floating into these 14 characters being trapped by the officers in the border. And it was very, very beautiful and very emotional, because suddenly, you know, I broke the dictatorship of the frame, let's put it that way. So instead to be a whole, that you see a fragment of reality, you were basically navigating and walking 360 degrees, walking with these guys.
Virtual reality, right? You could turn around and look. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And it was an incredible experience, because it's everything that cinema is not. So, I mean, this literally, you become the camera, you become the character. And then the police officer was pointing at you, you know? So wherever you move, you were really being threatened. So you become those guys in a radical way, and physically your body was present there and feeling the details about it. So very much, I think, was a big important thing for me to make this actually film, you know?
Mm-hmm. Alejandro, tell me a little bit about the impetus of doing something like that, because your experience as a guy who's a filmmaker who is from Mexico, who grew up in Mexico City, I'm assuming, yeah?
Yeah.
And then to make a film about this migration of people crossing, you know, the desert and doing that, what is your relationship from that side of the perspective? You know, because, you know, we're fed all sorts of different narratives here about immigration and people, you know, migrating north across the border and blah, blah, blah. From where you are physically, what is that perspective shift? What is your, you know, obviously you were driven to make a film, as sort of a film experience about it. Where does that land with you? Where does that sit with you, that dynamic of the sort of migration of people?
Well, I think in L.A., where I live now, and I have been living here, there's almost like 5 million Mexicans, right? And for that project, I interview like more than 500 immigrants with incredible, you know, heartbreaking stories.
Wow.
Yeah.
There was a mom that crossed 7 times to bring one by one of her daughters, and it took her 20 years working as a maid. God. Getting money little by little to go back and then turn back. And the way these guys abuse them, like the coyotes that charge them a lot of money,
yeah.
And then they left them even in the other side of the border, and making them believe that they are in the United States, and the way they are treated. And then the most heartbreaking kind of thing is the kids that has been taking him here for, you know, when they are 3-4 years, and they don't know they are not citizens, that they don't belong to nothing. And that's the real battle, you know, that suddenly they realize at 18 that they don't have any rights, that they don't have a future, and they don't know even how to speak Spanish. And there's no way for them to go back, because there's no other territory. So those stories for me has been always close to me, and obviously, you know, socially, I know many of these stories, and so I feel very close, even when my circumstances has been completely different. I have been incredibly lucky, supported, privileged, but anyway, that doesn't mean that I'm not feeling kind of close to these stories, and so, I mean, for me, it's just the situation of so many millions of people is really hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard to understand.
Yeah.
that's actually a nice segue into a question that I've had, which is, you know, and forgive me because I'm asking because I don't know. I'm uneducated in this area, but, you know, growing
what
up.
What weighs more, a bag of Skittles or a bag of M&M's? Sorry.
But, you know, growing up in Chicago and in America, we have these tremendous resources to, you know, when I grew up in Chicago, I was like, oh, Hollywood. And, you know, there's universities and colleges now where your major can be filmmaking and everything in this country. And there are programs in other countries too. But what was it like for you as a kid? What kind of resources did you have? What kind of anything did you have growing up to know that this is your path?
To prepare for this career, you mean?
Yeah.
No, you cannot prepare. I think that I never thought that I would be living here. You know, our plan was after Amores Perros, my wife and I decided to come here for 1 year.
Yeah.
The situation in Mexico, I'm from a generation that in our country, there was only 6 to 7 films being made a year. So there was no actually, you know, something that as filmmakers, Alfonso Cuarón or Guillermo del Toro or Chivo Lubezki, we had to come to look for something that we want to pursue, which was a filmmaker career. And we couldn't, our country cannot provide that at that time.
Right.
Security was not very, very good as it is even now. So when you become a public figure, it's a little challenging. So in a way, we have 2 little kids and we said, well, let's go 1 year. And then 21 years has passed and it feels that it happened in 1 week. You know?
Yeah.
That's part of the, and that's what the film is kind of, that's what the reason I make this film, like to clean the closet emotionally and just to put things in order, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you don't have to leave, you are from Toronto, or I have a lot of friends, American friends that are from little towns in the South and they are living here. And when they return, all their friends or their family stays one way that they have been evolving and transforming.
Yeah.
And it's a huge change. I mean, there's that's another battle. You don't have to leave your country to feel that your past is not belonging to you anymore. You
know,
or that was another person kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Talk to me about music. So you started with working radio, DJ, and interviewing some incredible people. But you've also done a little bit of scoring for films before you became a director. Yes. And then
yes.
I also want you to talk about the strategy for doing the music in Birdman, where the camera would actually show the drummer every once in a while. It's inventive and so bold and so exciting for an audience member, and that you're able to pull all those big swings off somehow. Just talk to me about music and film and how you enjoy writing music for films as well.
You know, when I in a way writing and developing and thinking about a film, as I told you, it's so important for me to hear the film, listen to the beat, the rhythm, and how it sounds. So I always felt that, you know, I was very clear with Amores Perros that it sounds like Sticky Fingers of the Rolling Stones, for example, that album. It was that sound that I wanted to portray. And then there are sometimes I listen to one album only when I'm, you know, 21 Grams. I hear to Pat Metheny album that I love about, it was in a spiritual film there was something attached to some song that suddenly I get stuck to that.
Yeah. And what are you saying that the album you listen to or the songs you listen to creates imagery in your head? Is that what you're saying?
It just creates a mood, you know? I think it's something that suddenly the sound of an album can portray you a mood, and the sound in a way, there's something that makes me feel close to the pace, to the spirit of the film. And for me, super, you know, and in Birdman, for example, I knew that I need drums because I knew that I wanted to make a one take by that reason of the radical point of view. So being a comedy, I said, oh shit, I mean, comedy, as they said, is made in cuts, right? And it's like the rhythm it's creating, the editing room. I knew that I will not have that opportunity, so I needed a rhythm. Right. I need something.
Or like a rim shot, right? It sort of ends a joke or ends a scene and carries you into the next one.
Exactly. And then I have been very lucky because my first 4 films, I worked with Gustavo Santaolalla, which is an incredible musician, and he do like minimalistic things, you know, with a couple of guitar moves and things. He just create again. I like to use very minimalistic music in that sense.
Yeah.
And So every experience has been different. Then in Revenant, I work with Ryuichi Sakamoto, that you cannot ask for more than the master Sakamoto, yeah, and it was great. Another experience. And then in this one, I did it with Bryce Dessner, you know, which is incredible
from
musician.
The National?
From the National, yeah. Bryce is just you know, so eclectic. I mean, he do classical music, he do jazz, he do everything. So I was able to work with him this time, and it was fantastic.
And you do have all those different sounds in it, yeah.
Bryce is a super talented guy. He and those guys just did that. My buddy Bon Iver just did a collab with those guys, but Jason doesn't. Do you like Bon Iver at all, Alejandro?
I love Bon Iver.
Oh, no kidding.
Now I do.
Keep going.
Now I do.
Yeah. Keep going.
No, that guy is genius. And he has Bryce has just worked with Tom York, too. So, even with this, Steve Reich, you know. So he's in all these kind of genres, you know. It's crazy.
Thank you, Alejandro. Thank you, Jason.
Who don't like Bon Iver?
Jason's made fun of it for like 2 years because he doesn't. Now that he thinks the cool kids like him, he's going to be all over.
Now I'm on. You said Tom York. I'm in.
Oh my God. I'm rage quitting this episode.
We'll be right back.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challenger, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who has taken her husband Art and transformed him into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt him out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a Challenger event close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when he finds himself standing across the net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Past and present collide and tensions run high. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at ChallengersMovie.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/smartlist to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/smartless. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. I'm Misha Brown, and I'm the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Every week, guests join me to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time. Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? They never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
And now back to the show.
Let me stop you at Revenant for one second.
Revenant's good.
I apologize if you've answered this question on this subject before. I'm sure you have, because I don't know if a sequence will ever be made that is the more the bear fight is something that when I was watching it, I knew it wasn't real, obviously, because Leo takes a lot of risks, but that one would be too much. and so I'm studying I saw it in a big theater too, and I'm looking for where's the cut? Where's the special effect? How are they doing? And I could not see it, not once. And to your point about one take, it was a oneer, was it not? It was all. So why would you, in something so technically difficult as that sequence, why would you choose to really make it even more tough by making it one take? How did you come to that decision?
I did a lot of research about the bear attacks and the description of it. There's a book, actually, of people that survived. It's a weird book with 120 cases of people that has survived bear attacks.
I'd love to read that.
Oh, my God. Sean's seen over 120 bear fights over a long weekend once during Pride.
On Santa Monica. Right.
So when I was reading these attacks, normally it was about the cops. You know, when you cross and they are cops, they're close, then you know that you are screwed. You know that you are in danger. And the description of the people, the way they felt it, the way they remember, the way they felt, again, they experience in a point of view of them. And it was shocking to see, you know, the fear, everything. So I said, I would love, instead to rely on the cutting and in the objective point of view of a filmmaker and a camera seeing things and putting pieces together, I would like, again, to observe and just to be present as if I'm witnesses that in real time, which will be the most terrifying thing, how somebody's being devoured. Yeah. And I remember with Werner Herzog, remember his documentary and that moment that Werner is sitting with the headphones and he's hearing how this guy was devoured and how these guys were devoured by this. And I said, Werner, what did you hear? He said, Alejandro, you don't want to hear. I said, you don't want to tell me what I heard. And what he described me, we were in a dinner. It was so terrifying what he described me about that. You know, the bears, in a way, first pull out your skin, and little by little, what I'm saying, they don't kill you immediately. They want warm meat, and so they keep you alive, and they are taking your skin off little by little. So they are devouring you in pieces. Jesus. Anyway, the descriptions that I have were so terrifying that I want the audience to, for a moment, try to put the audience in witnessing something so horrific like that. So that's why I decided to do that.
When you decided that this is what you would love to do, that's your ambition, but then you've got to check it with who, your visual effects supervisor or Chivo, or who told you that this was going to be possible? Because I don't think anyone's ever seen anything like that before. And it'd be tough to see it again. You know, I don't know if everyone's ever going to be able to do that again, but who told you that was technically possible to do?
Well, I think that it's possible because I think the visual effects and the CGI has arrived to a point that I was really, you know, worried that it will look good. And but I have to credit here ILM. I think they did an amazing job by creating this incredible, believable bear with all the hair. So now the technology allow you to create something like that, but you have to just prepare it very well. You know, you have to really have a good idea how you want to make it. So we rehearse for weeks. First of all, the blocking and then obviously study and analyzing how really a bear will hit you, will scratch you, will do it. So we have some expertise about that. And what I read was I was applying to what it was actually factual of the attacks of the bear. So then with Leo, we start rehearsing with a trainer, with a stunt that will be doing kind of the bear character. And we were saying, okay, now he will do that. Then he will grab it by the leg. He will drag him here. And then she and I start designing the camera move to understand what. So little by little, we were kind of shaping the moments. And then we knew that we had to make it in one shot. So we start rehearsing with the camera, Jesus. With the stunts, with Leo. And then we knew that we will have to use arneses, you know, too.
Yeah, the harnesses, the wires. He was tied up to a bunch of wires. It had to pull him all over the place with, as a bear would easily pull and push and throw him all over the place.
Yeah.
It was very challenging because we shot that actually in the middle of the woods, you know, in Vancouver. Yeah. So in a way it was, you know, we had to prepare the whole territory, the arnes, the camera didn't have to cross with that. So again, that's a boring and technical thing that I don't think is so difficult. I just think you need to have a clear idea what you want to achieve, and then everything almost is possible.
You have to have the bare necessities.
Oh, very nice. Bare necessities, Sean says. He loves
bare
a pun.
Necessities. Talk to me, Alejandro, about your relationship with your collaborator, writer Guillermo, and I don't want to say his name wrong.
Arriaga.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that relationship. You guys worked together on a lot of films, yeah?
Yeah, we did three films together. That was this trilogy that was, we were exploring, you know, the possibilities of structures and how, you know, people, your one event in a way was affecting different lives in a different way.
Sure.
Or in Babel, that was extreme, you know?
Is Guillermo the cinematographer or writer? Like
the writer. Sorry, the writer.
Got it.
Yeah. But I was sort of asking more. Yeah, I know that you guys were creating this incredible trilogy but the relationship that you guys have and how that changes over writing three films together and that process of your relationship and what that, you know, for instance, my relationship with, I'm going to mention Chappie again, a guy that I write with whom I love and I adore, and I have such a deep connection with him because we spend so much time writing in a room together and what that relationship, anyway, you guys have written these great films together. Talk to me about your personal relationship and how it has sort of brought you guys together or how it's changed and I don't know.
I think that I think we met in 1997. So we start developing like short stories that end up being Amores Perros first, and it was a great a time for both of us. You know what I mean? We were sharing the same kind of sensibility, writers. Faulkner was kind of an inspiration about his rawness, raw and humanity and things. So in a way, we were sharing a lot of things during those years, you know, and that was very, very profound because when you share, it's very hard to find a collaborator that you share points of view, you know, or sensibilities and sources of inspiration. So it was great. And I think that after the last film, you know, I think it was great because I was a little bit burned out about the structure and the fracture narratives, and I wanted to make a film about one single character, which for me was super unconventional, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then it ends, you know, any creative relation sometimes find an end or a transformation, and then you need to find yourself. And then the next film in Beautiful, I use found two co-writers that were fantastic, which is Nicolas Jacobone, which is the one who I have been collaborating in this last film, and Armando Bo. So anyway, I think for me it was a way to be evolving and transforming, and that relation in a way was very, very, very productive by having three films and was great, you know, was great.
All right, lastly, Alejandro, we've been heaping so much praise on you about how good you are at making movies. What are you terrible at? Are you really bad at anything? How about singing or dancing or sports or anything like that? What are you worst at?
I am so bad in almost everything, let me tell you.
I don't believe the only thing
that I try to attempt to do my best is to make films, but I'm so bad. My hands are really clumsy, let me put it that way. I cannot draw, for example. I cannot draw an apple.
You don't storyboard yourself?
No. No, I don't storyboard myself. Uh-huh. I would love to, but I can't.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to be a musician, and I have terrible fingers to play the guitar, so I'm absolutely bad with my hands are clumsy. So in a way, the only thing that I could possibly do is what I do. I think that's why I do what I do.
Well, please,
I'm very bad in most
things.
Please
keep doing it. You're one of our greatest ever, and I love watching everything you do.
You don't need to be good at anything.
Oh, you're very kind.
Please keep going.
You make incredible films. Really,
I'm so glad that you enjoy Bardo. I really hope that you two guys see it, and I'm very happy.
Bardo is just.
I'm gonna see it like this weekend.
I can't wait.
I'll I'll go with you. Let's go see it in a movie theater. I want to go with you and see it in a theater this time.
I will totally
it's just
do that.
Stunning. Everybody should rush
out. I just want to tell you something. I think when you see it, guys, don't try to demand logic on it, okay? So, I mean, turn off your co-pilot of rational demandings and just let yourself go.
I wake up and go to bed that way.
Yeah. And it goes by in about 10 minutes. It is one of the fastest watches I've ever seen too. You just get transported. It's great.
I can't wait.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, guys, to include me in this podcast. It's fantastic to talk to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, man, I feel cultured, bathed.
Yeah.
Bathed in greatness.
Great guy.
Well, guys, thank you for letting me vomit all over my hero there.
He's great.
I know. Do you think that we'll be able to cut in any of him talking for the first 20 minutes?
Was I going on? I was in a blackout.
I love that. That was so
cool. No, it was good. It was good. No, you were obviously like super into it, and he...
I mean, the guy's got more talent than... I mean, he could probably, if time would allow, he could probably make 3 or 4 great movies every year.
I know.
It's pretty stunning. And what a nice person too, right?
Super sweet and super sort of generous with like his process.
Where do you see this movie too?
Yeah, he seems like a very calm director, like a calm presence. Like there's some directors that are like, you know, like I would be a terrible director because like, what's going on? And I'd freak out. But like, he's more like, hey, we're going to make this happen and everything's going to be just fine.
Sean, would you do Revenant too?
Sure.
If he was like, I'm going to do Still Revan.
Pending script approval.
Still Revan.
Yeah. Would you do a movie called Bear Attack? And the whole movie is just you.
Yeah, we can film it in my bedroom.
You running from Scotty.
You wrestling Scotty? Yeah. Well, let's be honest. That's Cub Attack. I mean,
that's Cub Attack. That is Cub Attack, which is a lot easier to get out of.
But you don't speak bear, do you? You're not bilingual. Bye.
Very nice. Smart.
Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Rob Armjarf, Bennett Barbaco, and Michael Grant Terry. Smartless. If you like Smartless, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Get to the chopper. I'll be back. Listen, I gotta tell you, of all guests we've had on Smartless, I don't know if we've had a bigger icon on our podcast than Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, what a treat it was talking to that guy. Arnold is an inspiration, from having reached the heights of bodybuilding to then conquer Hollywood and become a global movie star. Oh, and for his third act, he oversaw the world's fifth largest economy as governor of California. The man has truly done it all. In our interview, he shares the secret of how he's able to accomplish what he puts his mind to, what motivates him to keep working out all these years, and the extreme generosity that he received after arriving in America. You gotta listen to this episode to hear what it's like to be Chris Pratt's father-in-law and how Arnold's first comedy, Twins, has made him more money than any other film he's done. Hint, he's also a great businessman. Give it a listen if you haven't. Bye, Seps.